The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of The Heretic's Hour on Monday, July 30th, 2012. I am your host, Carolyn Yeager, and I'll be with you for the next 2 hours with my very special guest for tonight, Jet Rucker. If you are a reader or follower of CODO, the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, you know of Jet Rucker as a writer, and you have certainly seen his name on articles. If you're not a frequenter of CODO, you can get to know him tonight for the first time. I should have warned him, which I forgot to do. I'll let him know right now that I have kind of a longish little bit of stuff to say here before we start our talk, so I hope he'll be patient. I just wanted to say that CODO and VHO.org and Castle Hill Publishers are three very good organizations and sources of information, but they are what I have started to call conservative revisionism. However, that's much better than no revisionism at all, and these are certainly these people have done a whole lot of work, certainly much more than I have. I'm nobody to be criticizing them, and I'm really not criticizing. I'm just pointing out some things that we're going to, and this is what our program tonight is going to be about in large measure. And so, in my opinion, we need a branch of a more radical revisionism. In the past, I've used the word aggressive. I don't really like either one. But examples of this would be Friedrich Paul Berg, but he didn't want to talk about this subject tonight that we're going to discuss, and he's really only interested in talking about what's on his website, NaziGassings.com. I'll give him a little plug there. And this program being live is not at the right time for European-based revisionists, and they are fairly conservative too. So I'm here alone with Mr. Rucker as the representative of my radical revisionism. Admittedly, that's not a very good name for it either. But I also want to announce some news about the Einsatzgruppen book, which I asked for donations from good friends of revisionism last year. I went back to look for when exactly I did that, and I didn't have time to find it. But it was sometime last year, because I knew that Jürgen Graf said that they wanted to do this. I asked him about it. They had this plan. They wanted to do this book on the Einsatzgruppen, and that's the one area after they finished all this work on the Action Reinhardt camps. But they didn't have the money to have the microfilm turned into computer readable pages or whatever that is, and it was quite expensive, and so I decided I was going to donate a fairly good amount of money and asked for people to donate, and you know, we came up with $5,000. True, the last 500, or maybe it was the last 1,000, but I think it's the last 500, I'm not sure, came from somebody else that came through, somebody that they knew of, and gave that, but it's amazing, and I want to thank the people who donated to that, and I don't remember all of them, but I know Hans Krampe gave $500, Hans Krampe from Canada. Deanna Spingola, I'm sure she sent a donation. She said she would, and I don't know what it was, but she's a very generous person. Charles Kraft gave money. Wilhelm Christman gave money. Harvey Taylor gave money, and I know there are others, and I'm really sorry that I didn't do my homework here well enough to say who they all are, but I want to announce that I got a letter. I wrote to Jürgen Graf and asked him what was the deal with that book, you know, because I knew that they were working on something that came up in the meantime that they felt they had to do, and so I just wanted to know, and he very nicely wrote back to me, and this was a couple of weeks ago. He said that they, you know, they had to respond to this attack by those five so-called Holocaust historians. I won't mention the word he used, what he called them. It's funny. Too bad I can't mention it. But he said, while I have written my part of the answer a long time ago, he's done his part on that book, and Thomas Cuse will probably finish his part by the end of July. Mantogno, Carlo Mantogno, will need another 1.5 months until he finishes his chapters. And this is on this book about answering the five guys who criticized their book on Sobibor. So they have to finish that. So he says then Mantogno's chapters will have to be translated into English. So because Carlo doesn't write in English. So this book will hardly be ready before late autumn. But as to the Einsetz grouping project, he talked about some things and where they're going with that, and that Thomas and Carlo have a great deal of a huge amount of documents to deal with. And anyway, the end of that is that book will only be ready in early 2014. Well, that didn't sound so bad. This is 2012, early 2014. So, you know, another year or so. They haven't actually gotten started on it yet, but at least it's always good to know that, you know, where they're at with it and that they have it on the schedule and what the timeline looks like. So, and of course, he reminded me that they needed 8 months to write the book about Sobibor, and which definitely is not easy, but it's less complex than the Einsetz group in question, which is truly, you know, is difficult. But a lot of people are waiting eagerly for that, and that's why I wrote about it. So we do have an answer to that, folks, and I just thought I should go ahead and mention it on the air, since that's where I started with the whole project. Now, I want to now say hello to Jet Rucker. I already introduced you, Jet, but so that I introduced this stuff in the meantime. So hello, and how are you tonight?
Well, hello, Carolyn. I'm really pleased to be here. I don't know when I've been in a position to have so many people, dozens, listening to me all at the same time.
Oh, yeah, we have quite a few listeners tonight.
Quite a feeling. I'm more accustomed to being ignored.
Well, you know, some of us get accustomed. We do get used to being ignored, and we're much more comfortable that way.
Oh, but, you're so right. There's a comfort there. It reminds me of something Lily Tomlin once said. She said, "The reason I'm able to speak my mind as frankly as I so often do is that nobody's listening to me."
Well, if she imagines that would make it easier, yes.
Yeah, I believe people do listen to her. I do.
I used to love her. I just loved her. She was one gifted woman, gifted comic. Well, why don't you tell us something about yourself? You know, your name is seen quite a bit, but there's not too much information. Of course, you're not expected to say anything you don't want to say, but people would be interested in knowing how you got associated with Kodo and are now such a busy writer for that organization.
Yeah, I'm an exponent. I flatter myself to think of revisionism, and my being so is partly a matter of atonement for having been very much the other way for most of my long life. I'm 68 now. Partly a matter of revenge. And as for the revenge, I'll get into that later. It's a familiar tale. It's nothing especially unusual with me. But in any case, as I just implied, I am of German descent on my mother's side, American on my father's. And I don't know if it was a morbid inclination, but I took a great interest in the Holocaust from long before it acquired its brand name of the Holocaust. When I started into the subject, Holocaust was likely to be a nuclear Holocaust. I don't know if anybody remembers terminology like that, but
yes, I do.
Yeah,
I'll admit to it.
Mm-hmm. And I started in high school studying it. By the way, I come from South Florida, and in that I do so, I mean, it was a bit like, almost like coming from New York, in that Jews were very numerous around me. It even happened occasionally that I made friends with one or two, or that they acted friendly toward me, which not many people of any persuasion did much. But anyway, so they were, unlike the situation if I'd grown up in Topeka or Santa Fe or something, they were a very, very real prominent presence to me. And that combined with my German background just added to my interest in the entire matter.
I can see that, yes.
Yeah. I studied it on and off, obviously. I didn't devote my life or attention to it with anything like the fervor to which I attend to revisionism. But I became an expert in it, but the way I would put it at this time would be I became an expert in the myth, even as the mythology grew. And I don't know if I'm anticipating your question, Carolyn, but the scales fell from my eyes one night about 2 years ago, pretty recent in this long life I'm going on about so long. And I was having dinner with a close friend and a close, long-time intellectual companion. And we were discussing the allegations of a nuclear threat on the part of the Ahmadinejad regime in Iran. I made a very passing casual reference to one of his recent speeches in which he expressed his disbelief of the Regnant Holocaust story. And my companion, to my surprise, practically blew up and subjected me to a long lecture that she didn't want to hear any conversation suggesting any sort of sympathy for what she called Holocaust denial. Now, at that time, I was already aware that Holocaust denial was a crime in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and places. You could get thrown in jail for it, and that deeply offended the value I attached to freedom of speech. In any case, as she went on in this surprising tirade, it came to me like a thunderclap. This person, again, I knew her very well for many years, this person on this matter has been brainwashed. And from there, the entire edifice came down. Oh, I don't know. Think of the World Trade Center. it just came.
Oh, you had one of those epiphanies.
You bet I did. The walls of Jericho. It just tumbled in on me. And right then and there, I decided to look in on it from a perspective informed by Norman Finkelstein's book on the Holocaust industry, and a matter I was with and rather outraged about in its own right. Now, you know, you don't have to be any sort of revisionist to be upset about what Finkelstein describes in the Holocaust industry, but I got that book, read it, and continued right on into the canon. I had the good fortune early on to run into Arthur Butz's masterpiece. Carolyn, can you quote the title verbatim?
Yeah, the Hoax of the 20th Century.
Yeah, that's right, that one. I still think that book is the central item, despite the magnificent work that has gone on since by all the people you named. And, you know, I don't think I heard Germar Rudolph's name.
No, I haven't named him, but of course he's, well, no, he's done, I mean, he more work than anyone. But I agree with you about Butz's book. It is the one that people have to read. It covers the whole thing in such a way.
And Butz did not have Butz to inspire him. People
right.
like even Rudolph and Matonio and Graf and Kues and so on, these people have got Butz to inspire them, to introduce them to the subject mm-hmm. and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Butz descended upon us like, oh, gosh, well, again, like a thunderclap. It was his idea. He figured it out practically by himself. I remain stunned by his achievement of 35 years ago or whatever it was.
Yeah, so well, anyway, good for you.
That's,
you know,
that's,
I've asked him to be on this program, but he doesn't want to be on a radio program.
That's,
so for those people who always write to me, say, why don't you have so-and-so on? Why don't you get so... I've always asked all these people that they mention usually, but for a lot of reasons, some people don't want to. And there's nothing for him to get out of it.
I know that you don't pay people much for being on these shows. In fact, I took the money you gave me in advance and tried to buy a stick of gum down downtown, and they wouldn't even give me a wrapper. But the thing is, none of these people, not Butz, nobody, they are not motivated by money or put off by the lack of it. That's my consistent experience. And that brings me further to something about Butz. You know something? I am guessing that Butz ended up making a penny or two from his book.
It's probably sold pretty well.
Well, it so happens that the new ones sell at $30 a pop. Now, I think there's room for some royalties in there. And boy, if he made some money, well, I just hope so. Whatever he made, it's not 1% of what he should have made.
On top of that, he remains a professor. Isn't he professor status at the University of Chicago? He remains in his position there because he was tenured. And
yes.
Even though he has done the worst of the worst by writing about, you know, against the Holocaust, they can't get rid of him. And he has endured all sorts of persecution, to use that word, from the faculty and probably a lot of students there.
And the administration, everybody.
And the administration, they'd love to get rid of him, but they can't, and he doesn't back down, he doesn't leave. And he continued writing and speaking and going to conferences and so on amongst revisionists. So he is one courageous man, which everybody can look to and say, you know, for those who say, oh, well, I can't do this or because of this or that reason. Well, maybe he didn't. I don't know if he's got a family, but anyway, he took his chances because, as you say, he's just a truthful man, and he wanted to do it. He is German, I guess. That's a German name. I think that people of German ancestry, at least half German, you know, even more so if it's all or more, but feel it. You know, feel it strongly in a more personal way as something, as a libel that they would like to get rid of.
I do. I am occasionally accused of having an emotional investment in the subject. And I'd add, those accusations do not necessarily, although many do, they do not necessarily include terms like anti-Semitic. Rather, let's say Philo-Germanic. And you know something? I admit to that. I do not claim objectivity. I seek truth, and I do that with objective methods. But I have an emotional investment in this, and it is ignited by outrage at an utterly and absolutely unjustified calumny upon what I have taken to calling my people.
Aha, good for you. Well, that goes right to my heart.
No, well, I admit to it. That is my point. I admit to that, and that does not render me incapable or less capable of pursuing the truth.
Well, that's right. That's right. In fact, I think it gives people an incentive for finding the truth, truthfully. But anyway,
it is that for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What? How did you get? How did you meet? Did you meet Bradley Smith, or did you start? How did you meet the people at CODO?
I have never met Bradley, for that matter. Of course, I haven't met you.
Well, I haven't either.
Yeah. Oh, you haven't met Bradley. Yeah. Well, Bradley hangs out in Mexico in a place that's distant from where I live. It's this way. When I get caught up or involved in something, I write about it. It was most recently certain old cars, Chevrolets, of the 1960s. It was prior to that. It was, yes, economics. Stay with me now. Don't go to sleep. But when I'm interested in something, especially if I feel it needs to be advocated or spread about, I write about it and I seek publication. And I went and did this with a number of what I will call the operators in the revisionist field. And by far the best reception, including the highest fees, exactly nothing, I got that from Bradley Smith, who has afforded me quite a bully pulpit, excuse me, in his pages.
Okay, so you were looking for an opportunity to
as I emphasize, it was not a financial opportunity. And I didn't get paid for writing about old cars, although I did get published, and I did occasionally get paid very small amounts for writing about economics. I think that was sort of to offset the boredom or something.
Well, there's no money in revisionism.
Not at all.
There can be, I won't even bring that up because it's so little and so limited. So, no, this is all, Wes, what we call it, the truth movement, and there's different partitions of the truth movement, but when people who are seeking the truth about a particular subject, that has to be the goal, and that has to be the satisfaction in itself. And so either you have other income, like Arthur Butz, or you don't need any income anymore.
I live on love myself. It's cheap.
Oh, I love it. I hated when I had to work for money. I had to do things for money that I didn't particularly want to do. I always wanted to just be able to do what I was interested in doing and follow along with that. And I did pretty well with that. I managed to do that a lot of my life. And now, of course, I still am.
You're referring to making money by perhaps some disagreeable activities or boring ones?
Well,
what you had? Yeah.
Yeah, finally realize you're spending all your time to help somebody else make money, and you're not making very much yourself.
Well,
just a little, salary.
Sure.
But anyway, what I would like to put our attention on tonight is a page that I linked to in my announcement. Mm-hmm. So I hope some of the listeners have looked at it. And it is at vho.org. It's called Intro. Let's see. Let me go to this page.
Yeah.
And
here we are.
The whole page is Welcome to Our Introduction to Historical Revisionism. And it's, has questions and answers. What is revisionism? All these things. And I have looked at number 5 before. And I'm very still interested in talking about number 5. So that's the one that I mentioned. And this is what I'd like for us to start out discussing tonight, if you don't mind. And number five is, what does Holocaust revisionism claim? And this is where I bring in my radical revisionism to bear on what is here. And then from there I've gone to number four after five, and then I've gone on to number eight, and I've got some other things. And you can, you know, bring in whatever you would like here meantime.
Yeah, so, I'm looking at the bulleted list right now.
Yeah. So
there are some you disagree with and some you agree with, I guess. Yes?
Yeah, there's a couple I can accept as they are, and the rest of them I have something to say. First of all, now this is kind of old. You know, this is an old page, but it hasn't been updated. And I know that Guillermo Rudolph, who I like and respect very much, put this on something in his it's on his website right now. So he's satisfied with it. Mm-hmm. We say it starts out saying, first of all, because of false representation by the media, it is necessary that Holocaust revisionism does not maintain. Now, they make a point here that these are things that Holocaust revisionism does not agree with. It does not deny that Jews were persecuted under the Third Reich. Now, my reasoning here, I should explain, is that I would like to see, should maybe go up here a little bit, I would like to see us take a different attitude toward Jewish suffering. Because I think that when we start right out in the beginning and say, well, we know that the Jews suffered special persecution by the Nazis, and the Nazis were wrong in doing this. The Nazis were harsh and cruel and even evil. Lots of things are said, even on Kodo. And related type places about how the Nazis were really crimes. These were crimes that they committed against the Jews, and the Jews suffered, you know, extreme hardship and pain and death and so on. That wasn't right. It wasn't right that even though this happened, it doesn't add up to gas chambers and 6 million and so on. So all revisionists agree about the gas chambers of 6 million and so on, that's all, that none of that is true. And that is the big thing to get, because most people do still accept it as true. So that is the big thing to get across. But so we kind of jump over the other so that we don't appear to be anti-Semitic, right from the beginning. Now we know that you've had all these troubles. We know that you've suffered. And I think that this puts us in a bad position, because you may not be familiar, Jet, with an article, but see, I'm all kind of caught up in this article that Greg Johnson wrote, who has a website called Countercurrents, and he is a white nationalist, and I think
I read that article. Appeared on TOO recently.
Yes, it did. Good.
I read that whole article. It was very articulate, I must say.
Yeah, and he is arguing that that the Holocaust is kind of in the way, and white nationalists, and I know you, let's make very clear, you are not a white nationalist, but
no,
and neither is Kodo, nobody at Kodo is really, so
no,
he's trying to make this point that you can. He makes the point that because the Jews suffered and had this persecution, which nobody can deny, and this big pile of dead Jews, as he puts it, without giving a number or anything, just that we have to all recognize that there were this huge amount of innocent, too, he says, innocent Jews killed, that we can never undo that. We can never get over that. So we might as well just admit it and step over it and move on, and not be hung up, you know, with this story, or not accept guilt for it, because all the reasons, you know, we didn't do it, it was a long time ago, blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of us who really don't like that attitude, and this is why I have picked on this, gone back to this list again, and picked on this whole thing about the Jewish suffering, and I would like to really take a look at how true is this? is this true that they suffered a kind of persecution that others have not, and that this is going to go on into perpetuity? Because as you know from the Holocaust industry book, you know, it has, you know, that what they built it up into. And I think this is the base of it. So this is why I pick on this. And I realize I'm kind of, I'm picking a small area here. And I appreciate that you've agreed to come on and discuss this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, well, you have really taken a position that you well know will attract much more than your share of the firepower brought to bear by our common opponents. And it's brave of you. God, I certainly couldn't fault you for on the score of frankness. And of course, right now, I trust you're on the point of launching into an argument in favor of your position. So,
well, the argument that I have, I'll just start out with this first one. That we should not deny that the revisionists don't deny that Jews were persecuted under the Third Reich. And I have a question right here. I don't say that I deny that they were, but I don't accept that. You know, I'm not, would like to find out just how persecuted they actually were. I understand what happened to them, but I don't know about the word persecution. And whether or not I hate that phrase, but they brought it on themselves, or that it wasn't really unfair. So that's a better put. It wasn't so unfair as they want to make it out. And they weren't so innocent. So I just say, just how persecuted were they? We need to be more specific about this persecution rather than just accept it. Go ahead.
Could I offer you a wrinkle? It might be a bit new to your thinking concerning which Jews brought persecution, or whatever it was, on which Jews. Now, what I mean by that is this. We had in 1933 the ascendancy of the Nazi Party to control of Germany's government. And from that point, an anti-Jewish policy was launched. Now, immediately there occurred an opposing reaction from Jews. However, where were those Jews who were launching this opposing reaction? Answer, they weren't in Germany. They were in England. They were in America. To some extent, they were in Russia and France and so on. And I don't know if a similar situation arose, as it so happens, among Jews during the civil rights era in the South. You would get Northern integrationists busing down to Selma, Alabama, and like that. Jews overrepresented in these groups, of course. And these northern Jews would seek out the southern Jews who lived around there and say, hey, why aren't you with us here resisting the oppression of blacks? And these southern Jews almost unanimously said, hey, we live here. We are counted among the whites. Our friends are the whites. We have to continue living with them, and you are causing trouble for us. Now, going back to 1933 Germany, you've got boycotts in the United States. You've got Germans being snubbed in Jewish restaurants in London, not in Berlin. And if you see what I mean, misplaced solidarity. Prominent German Jews actually issued requests that I have seen in American newspapers, expressing the hope that foreign Jews will not be overly tough on the Germans or Germany, because these people, these German Jews were, whether first or second, they were Germans too. So
I'm aware of that, and I know that many Jews felt like Germans. In fact, even the big banker Now I can't think of his name, but you know the one. The German, the head of the big German bank, the big Jewish German bank, that everybody points to. But he was actually content in Germany, and he was making tons of money, you know, and he wasn't too worried about what the Nazis were going to do. And a lot of people didn't think that they were going to last that long. And they weren't all that afraid of it. So it was these international Jews, and it was England and America who were anti-German from the beginning and allowing these Jews to go about all this. So without any, they didn't say, oh, stop doing that or anything like that. So yes, but I would say that the Germans knew that the German Jews on most levels would cooperate with international Jewry, because they generally do, and that they weren't, and they didn't outwardly put up a big fight. They didn't say, oh, we're for our government, because they were also, they didn't like National Socialism because it was anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fact. It was. I think this Jewish war on Germany was real. It did have consequences. It was economically harmful to Germany at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one aspect, but there's a lot of things that the Jews about the persecution of the Jews, and we really have to go through them, and I think some of the other points bring them up. So if we go to number two, it says it does not deny that Jews were deprived of civil. Well, we don't deny that Jews were deprived of civil rights. Well, now my question is, why should Jews not be deprived of civil rights when they are in countries that don't want them, or when they are perceived by those in that? And there are a lot of countries like that who see Jews as not being loyal citizens in their country. And most of them, though, weren't going to do that much about it. But the National Socialist Party, was adamant from its beginning that was one of its policies that it was going to carry out. So civil rights means, you have to determine what the civil rights are. But I've got a list of five or six things here that I can mention. But before I do, I'll let you respond to that, because I know you're a strong civil rights supporter.
I am. Now, being American like you, and I suspect most of the listeners, I attach to civil rights a certain thing that goes back to the origins of the present American government. That is, that any person's civil rights are not to be deprived, are not to be withdrawn, without due process. Now, due process usually suggests the filing of charges and a hearing of evidence, the passing of a verdict, and then, of course, a sentence. And truth be told, as I go back to the scenario as I understand it in Germany in the 30s, as compared with due process, I think of the situation as more resembling a kind of a mob action. And I'm going to admit up front that there was one thing that, to some extent, partial extent, justified a panic in the anti-Jewish program, and that was the fear of communism in Germany. And now we're getting into something that I know you're aware of, and that's the conflation of Judaism with communism. And this is not an artificial or false conflation. It's a real, it's a genuine conflation. Many Jews were communists. Many communists were Jews. And you may have heard some theories and considered them that much of the anti-Jewish program of the Nazis was as much an anti-communist program. Does that square with your information?
Yes, that's right. That's mm-hmm. right. And I'm glad you.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I've given you one point you might have made right. otherwise.
Let me make a few more, and then you can mm-hmm. comment on those.
Yeah.
Now, Jews were seen as a fifth column in Germany during World War I. And talking about the communism was a very important thing, but another one, equally important, I think, was the experience of World War I and even more right afterwards, in that Jews were behind the Soviet takeover in Bavaria, turning it into mm-hmm. a Soviet republic for a short time. And there was a lot of communist agitation around that time. Well, that fits in with what you've already said, Jews mm-hmm. being the communists. But Jews were also prominent at Versailles in determining the treaty. Of course, they weren't the only ones. There are plenty of non-Jews that wanted to be as tough on Germany as possible. But the Jews were always behind the scenes there, and they always played a role.
Here you are speaking of non-German Jews. You're speaking of English,
true.
French,
yes.
American
yes.
Jews.
Yes.
Okay. I hadn't known that, but I certainly don't.
And also some of the. Also, I learned just last week that the German delegation to Versailles had two Jews in it, in the delegation.
Oh.
And somebody said, well, there was just two of them. But, you know, I said, there's two is too many. I mean, that why should there be Jews in that delegation going to determine the what rights Germany had or to defend Germany?
That was probably overrepresentation statistically. The population of Germany was smaller than the percentage that two would represent to the whole delegation. Yeah.
And then after the horrible Treaty of Versailles, and after Germans realized what a mess they were in and what a terrible deal they had been given, and that and Jews were considered to have been behind the push to have Germany surrender and lay down their arms and end the war. They couldn't mm-hmm. keep going, and they had agitated in the labor unions and so on. So all of this, there's a whole lot of truth to that. It's not just made up. And during the Weimar period, many Jews had come into the country from Eastern Europe, and then the ones who were already there, well, they pushed Germans out of positions and professions. They took over a lot of farms and other real estate because the Germans became more and more penniless because of the inflation and other reasons. And so the Jews managed, because of their fantastic business sense and business skills, to outwit the Germans there all over the place. And you had Germany in a very bad way. And Jews owned, this is well documented, Jews owned most of the businesses on the stylish Kurfürstendamm store, you know, where all those stylish stores are and so on, turned out that they went to check who the owners were. I mean, like 80%, I didn't look this up, but as I recall, it was a huge number, a huge percentage that were Jewish owned. And the Germans were shocked. I know what it was. When the Nazis put the name Jew-owned store or something on the front of all these stores, if they were, the people were shocked to see how many of them were owned by Jews, because they didn't know, because the Jews did blend very well into the society in Germany. And then they controlled most of the banks. I mentioned that banker whose name I can't come up with. And financial institutions, newspapers, the department stores. And they're the ones who built these department stores and put small German shop owners out of business, because the Germans never came up with the idea of big department stores. And so they just had their little stores, you know, and people went to them for everything different.
Something like this would seem to have happened in the United States regarding department stores.
Yes, that's true. They're the creators of the department store. And theater and motion pictures, even book publishing. I mean, everything was going into the hands of the Jews, including academic positions in the universities. This actually took place in the Weimar period. And it took a group of people like Hitler and his friends and the National Socialists to say, we're not going to tolerate this, because mostly the Germans were just tolerating it. And like we do in the United States, we're tolerating it, and we're losing out more and more and more while we just become more Judaized, and that's what was happening to the Germans. So this is where I say, why should people who are doing this continue to have their civil rights protected if they're doing so much damage to the majority of the people? Now, I also say, okay, what about the rights of the Germans? Well, that's what I just said. So that's the end of what I have to say on that one.
I find myself coming back to something like ethics. If I were religious, I would call it morals. And this has to do with demonization and persecution of a group. Now, I could say that it's wrong and nobody should ever do it, but I won't be that pedantic. I will say, not only do I hope I'm never part of such a group, I further hope I am never part of any group that has cause to demonize and persecute another group. According to your rendition of the facts, which, by the way, I do not dispute as facts. You haven't said anything that I consider mis or ill or even incompletely informed. Were the Germans justified in doing, or the non-Jewish Germans justified in doing what they set out to do to the Jewish Germans? As you see, I've phrased this so that it almost is a moral or ethical question. And it's easy enough to say no. I have relatives who lived in Germany at the time. One was active in the film industry, by the way. That relative's career actually began after the Nazis took power, and indeed, I consider her necessarily that her career was advanced by the elimination of Jewish competition.
There you go.
That's interesting. It's one of these undeniable overarching facts that can nowhere, no how be quantified. There's no way to say how she would have done had she not been up against Jewish competition. But in any case, from within my family, I have heard what I'll call witness testimony, generally agreeing with what you said. So all I can say is there's much truth to what you...
I would put it that that the Germans were being persecuted, even though it wasn't in the same way. It wasn't by a political party, but it was by a Jewish networking. And then when you call the Jews in Germany Jewish Germans, a lot of them were not Germans. They had come in from Russia and Eastern Europe.
That's very true. I'm well aware of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
Incidentally,
you know, often say, why don't the good Jews get together and do something about the bad Jews? They don't do it, do they?
Well, one reason is they considered them foreigners and immigrants first and only later Jews. They didn't identify with them. There is one point where I want to disagree with you. I cannot disagree on fact, but rather on impression, and that is, I do not think the immigrant Jews were in any position to impose this persecution you allege. I believe the persecution or dispossession or anything, I have a feeling that it was for the most part carried out by at least quasi-assimilated, nominally assimilated German Jews. Now, as to these immigrants, they were lower class and lower middle class, and this means that they went up against local tailors and junk men and small-time retailers, maybe in smaller towns, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. So they competed against, whether fairly or not, it's hard to say, but they competed against Germans of the lower classes, and undoubtedly aroused a good deal of anti-Jewish sentiment among lower class Germans, where along the way German Jews weren't even thinking of these foreigners as Jews. But anyway,
I like the fact that you use the word dispossession, and I like that word. That's what I should have come up with. It was more that than persecution. But if you have a people, no matter if it's because they're so talented or they're so clever or whatever it is, and in a libertarian way of thinking, you would say, well, they have every right because they're good competitors. Yeah. Well, but if they're dispossessing a people out of their own homeland, then should not something be done about it? Do they have the right to do that, or do they not? And this, I think, is the real key. I really appreciate what you've said here, because this is where it comes down to it. Don't the Germans have a right to protect themselves? And doesn't it take a German political party, and if that political party can come into power, as the National Socialists did, then they can do something to protect their own people, the Germans, from these dispossessors.
Well, you know that at certain points, the German government set about trying to deport, and actually deporting, foreign, in the case I'm thinking of specifically Polish Jews, from Germany. Now, this occurred, the incident I'm thinking of, and it involved a lot of people, occurred in 1938, immediately prior to Kristallnacht, which was November 9th of 38. And am I ringing any bells with you here? Do you recall that the German government set about deporting Polish Jews, of whom there were tens, if not hundreds of thousands, in Germany, and they took them on trains, by the way, passenger cars, not cattle cars. They took them and some possessions that these people were able to pack up and take with them, took them to the border with Poland, tried to put them across. At first, Poland would not accept them, even though they were documentably Poles. And then once the Germans made the Poles take these Jews across the border back into Poland, the Poles put them into, guess what, concentration camps. The first concentration camps for Jews in Europe were, Germany had prison camps too prior to this time, but they were not expressly for Jews. The Poles put those up at several locations along their border and kept these Polish Jews bottled up in there for I don't know how long, and I don't know where they went afterwards. I think a lot of them managed to get back into Germany. But if I may continue with the connection to the Night of the Long mm-hmm. Knives, I'm sorry, I'm mixing it up, to Kristallnacht, the guy... who ultimately shot the German diplomat in Paris, shooter's name was Grinspan. He was the child, possibly born in Germany, definitely grew up in Germany, of Jewish Polish immigrants to Germany. His parents had been deported. Now, this guy was angry about it, and that was probably foremost among his motivations in firing the shots that ultimately triggered Kristallnacht.
Yes. Yes, well, so do you think then what's justified there? I mean,
the expulsion of what I'll call illegal immigrants widely accepted as being among the rights of sovereign nations, which arguably Germany was at the time. There were many, as you said, there were many Russian and Czech Jews in Germany, along with other Eastern countries. And, well, Germany, as you see, did attempt to expel them or otherwise deal with them somewhat in the way the U.S. deals with illegal immigrants. And as you see, they encountered international resistance, including international Jewish resistance.
Yes, so Kristallnacht, a lot was made out of Kristallnacht beyond what it really was. And change. Well, we'll have to get into that when we come back. You know, we're almost ready for our one-hour break yet, so you see how fast this goes. We won't have any trouble filling up the last half. Somebody sent in a bit of information that Butz is an associate professor of electrical engineering at Northwestern University, an associate professor. I guess they never moved him up past that now. And he basically never gives interviews, which is nice because he didn't want to give him one.
Okay, then. I'll see you after the break.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We'll be back in 5 minutes.
I'm going to go get another beer.
Okay.
Okay. interesting that...
I'm muting.
Yeah. You hear me okay?
Hush. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back from our little break, and I'm here, Carolyn Yeager, with my guest, Jet Rucker, and we're talking about whether the Jews were really so persecuted and suffered so, or more likely, whether how innocent they were in their persecution and suffering as a basis for discussing Holocaust revisionism. So if you've been listening, you know that's where we are. And let me just say real quick that as I had said that back to Arthur Butz, that Arthur Butz was at the University of Chicago, and this person who wrote in corrected that he's a professor at Northwestern University nearby. So I thank him for that. Let's get back to where we were. Jet, if you want to say something to start out, you may, and otherwise we'll go to the next item on the list here.
Yeah.
Okay. The next item is Holocaust revisionism does not deny that Jews were deported. Well, that's one of the ones that I would agree with. I don't have any problem with that. Naturally, they were. But I hold that a national people have every right to deport a troublesome alien people out of their living space. And the Germans were, and this will take a while to talk about if you want to talk about it. The Germans were going about this in a fair and careful way in the beginning. They wanted to do it right. They allowed the Jews to take much of their wealth. They had training programs to help them. They had a place for them to go, which was in Palestine at the time, and they could go other places too. They just wanted them to leave Germany. Okay?
I'm perhaps reading the term deported here more broadly. I have a feeling your reading is correct. The term deported was used by the Germans when they would dragoon civilian Jews and put them in concentration camps.
Yeah, that's really what they're talking about here. I just added that in the beginning they were trying to do it in a nice way. And as things went on and the war started, then everything started changing. So that they were showing that they were immediately cruel cruel and inhuman to the German Jews. It was just that it turned out that way because of total war.
I'm inclined to say that those Jews who were taken into camps were many, if not most of them, what I call conscripted. They were drafted into forced labor. Well, forced labor is not the term. The term is slave labor. Forced labor is involuntary labor that you're paid for. Slave labor, you're not paid. Now, the interesting thing about these conscriptions, in a few cases, like in France, the Germans set about conscripting Jewish workers by themselves, that is to say, men without their families. This was a fairly famous incident that went down in Paris, and apparently at the initiative of the local police, the gendarmerie, the French, the Jews took their families with them, and the families were apparently accepted. It may even have kind of set the model for future conscriptions. So in this business of conscripting workers with their families, back in the army we used to call this an accompanied tour of duty. I don't know. It was ethnic cleansing combined with the recruitment of labor, the forcible recruitment of labor. But you know the ironic thing? I'm sure you know this, Carolyn. I don't know if all our listeners have it in mind. The funny thing is, it's not funny, but the peculiar thing is that at the end of the war, by the last year of the war, with the Germans losing territory, in particular to the Soviets, the Germans reversed their deportation policy and began importing large numbers of Jews back into Germany to man the war industries.
Well, that shows that was...
Yeah.
That shows that the war changed everything, and they needed labor so badly. And so their whole policy about Jews changed. And, you know, while there's no denying that they wanted to rid Germany eventually of every Jew if they could, although I don't know that that was really their expectation in the short term, because that was, you know, they really didn't mind some of them. But then when the war came, they decided, well, we have all these Jews, we want to send them out, but in the meantime, we better use them for labor. And if they don't, and if the labor is hard and they don't survive too well, well, we don't really care about that. I would agree with that. I mean, I agree that that's how, that was the attitude. By then, they were trying to save their own national life and their own lives.
They were protecting their country against invasion. A friend of mine, actually the same friend that I described having dinner with an hour ago, pointed out that if the Japanese had invaded the United States in 1942 on the West Coast and succeeded in conquering California and proceeded onward toward the heartland, those Japanese that the U.S. had rounded up and put in concentration camp, A, would have been conscripted for labor, and B, would eventually have suffered fates not unlike those suffered by the Jews as Germany was conquered by invading armies. Now,
right.
I think my friend redeemed herself. I must say, grudgingly, she has come around to my point of view, and that's sort of a happy ending. She is still my friend.
Good. I think that's very fair, what you just said, too. And, of course, she said it.
About
well,
the Japanese.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and then it's not only Germans who put people to work. And, of course, in the United States, when they rounded up the German Americans, or they were actually, most of those who were rounded up were not American citizens, but they had been there. They had been in America for a good amount of time, and some of their children were. But that didn't matter. So they all went into these camps. Now they weren't labor camps.
No, they weren't.
But they were not so good because the conditions were not that great, and you had nothing to do.
Sometimes it's
better to work and have something to do.
It is. And by the way, there was work done in particularly the Japanese camps. This work was voluntary, and it was paid at a nominal rate. So if the conditions were better there than at Auschwitz, well, guess what? The U.S. wasn't invaded. So.
Yeah, the U.S. wasn't in the state that Germany was in. And I know a man who was in a German as a young man. He was in one of those camps, and I remember him saying that he got some kind of a job delivering ice because it was down in the South Texas and very hot, and everybody needed ice all the time for their little ice boxes. And he got a little bit of money for that. Oh, the pay wasn't very good. And I don't know that it was the government that paid him. Somebody paid him.
Yeah, sounds like he was allowed outside the camp.
I don't think so.
No, in the camp then.
Yeah. I think just delivered the ice around to the different houses, the different little huts that they had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it does not deny the existence of Jewish ghettos. All right, now somehow the Germans are supposed to be so responsible for putting Jews into ghettos. And, you know, I say that Jews have been ghettoizing themselves from all the way back, and they choose to live among themselves. Even today, they create communities that are all amongst themselves. And except for the ones, let's look at Germany, those who were ambitiously wanting to enter and rise to the top of white society, they tried to act like they weren't Jews and they wanted to, you know, mix in. But a lot of Jews, that's the way they prefer to live. So they really didn't have it that bad in those ghettos. What about the Warsaw ghetto? The Warsaw ghetto wasn't so bad until they started their uprising there.
Uprising. Do you know, ghetto, as you can see if you look at it and listen to it, ghetto is an Italian word, and it arose, according to what I've heard, in Italy, of course, in Venice, where there is, in Venice today, a ghetto, as it's called. It is where Jews lived and still live, and it is, as far as I know, quite voluntary on the Jews' part. The Jews are allowed, along with anybody else legally landed in Italy, to live anywhere they please. But this ghetto in Venice, by the way, is a tourist attraction, and it is among several such sites that I toured not just Venice, but elsewhere in Italy. I recommend it to the curious tourist. It did not, to my eye, display much that was obviously Jewish. A synagogue, maybe, you know, but otherwise, another of Venice's interesting neighborhoods. This business of containment, no doubt it appeals to separatists like you, Carolyn.
Mm-hmm.
but I don't know if it's quite as distant as you might like, but maybe as a half measure it appeals to you. And it, you know, it appeals to the libertarian in me in that it is voluntary on the part of the inmates. I have nothing against people separating themselves out by groups, colors, language, sexual orientation, anything. The freedom of association is badly compromised in many countries, including the United States, and that is a matter of ongoing concern to me. I celebrate diversity sometimes as an individual, but I never put it upon anybody else, aside from maybe my co-celebrant, to do that. I consider it a taste, not a virtue.
Okay. All right. So how important is this that Jews, that there was such a thing as Jewish ghettos? Is this some kind of persecution of Jews? I mean, does this fit into the fact that at the end of these items, oh, we've got a few more.
Yeah,
these things are all called crimes. You know, these are the crimes of the National Socialist regime.
Well, it doesn't exactly say that here, but I guess it's a granting of points to the opposition. Whatever the opposition says these things are, it says in this list that they were unjust. Now, a forcible ghetto, a ghetto populated by people taken out of their own homes, perhaps without compensation, and plunked down in some crummy neighborhood, well, this is rude. I shouldn't care to have it done to me, but...
Well, no, a lot of things we wouldn't care, but during wartime, a lot of things happened. A lot of people suffered much worse than being forced to go into the ghetto.
They sure did. You know, it occurred to me, if I may go back, and we should be going forward, I know, but I'm thinking about the Jews I mentioned who were brought back into the Germany to man factories, whose workers, by the way, were off at the front getting shot at, starved, frozen, bombed, forced to retreat. In other words, whatever poor conditions the Jews brought into Germany for labor were subjected to, they were, if you make the comparison, probably no worse than the conditions being faced by the people who had previously been doing those jobs.
Well, yes, and they also were better off than if they were over in the area where the war was going on.
Very much so.
You know, and there were still Jews living around there, and I imagine some of those didn't survive. But these people were better off. All right, let's go on to the next one. Holocaust revisionism does not deny the existence of concentration camps. Well, that's another one. Of course not. Jews and others were sent to various types of camps. The early camps, I think, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, substituted for prisons and were fairly work camps. Yeah,
I called them that. I called them prisons.
Yes, you did. You did. And then I just say that Germans believe in these kind of camps, and they believe that work is the solution to many ills. That's what I came up with.
Especially when you make them do it.
Well, you know, but if people are what they would consider misfits, if people are some of these ones who, you know, they considered weren't good for society, and they put them in these camps, they thought if they put them to work and gave them a little bit of indoctrination and so on, they might change some of them and make them into better citizens.
They did that in great numbers. They did that to Germans. They did that to non-Jews. And by the way, of course, after they thought these people had been rehabilitated, boy, I'd have been rehabilitated in the first day, I think. But anyway, great numbers of them, they released. And oddly, I cannot make sense of this, but a goodly number of Jews seem to have been released from these camps. There is a widespread misimpression from the propaganda that nobody ever got out of a concentration camp alive unless he survived to what's called liberation. That is not so. And of course, there were escapes, but in much greater numbers, there were releases.
Yes, especially in the beginning. I mean, people, they were sentenced according to law, just as you were saying earlier, that there had to be a lawful process so you don't violate people's civil rights. Mm-hmm. And they were given a certain sentence, and when that sentence was up, they were released. So they were even released from Auschwitz.
Oh, yes, most definitely.
3,000 or so were released from Auschwitz.
In thousands, they definitely were.
Yeah. Okay, and then it says a silly thing, but this is shows the public, the mind, about how confused the people's minds are about what goes on in these camps. And it says it does not deny the existence of crematoriums in concentration camps.
Oh, that's crazy. Of course, those were a hygienic measure, just like the use of Cyclone B.
And there weren't enough crematoriums or enough crematorium ovens to take care of what they say happened there in these places, in these huge numbers of millions, hundreds of thousands. So the number of crematorium ovens that existed in these camps were commensurate with the number of people that were held there, and there were always deaths, and there were a lot of older people there.
There were older people. There were epidemics, too, as you know. I believe, you know, a crematorium is an anti-epidemic measure. If a person dies of old age, it's perfectly reasonable just to bury them. They don't generally pose any sort of risk. If, on the other hand, they died of typhus or some other such thing, then the body is contagious and is a source of future disease for people who are still living and healthy. Crematoria are a sanitary measure.
The Germans put so much attention on hygiene in these camps of theirs. And people, you know, that, of course, has been misconstrued and misrepresented in every kind of way by these survivor-type people who want to tell these stories.
I get regularly laughed at for saying that. And it is at the point where I say that Cyclon B was a hygienic and health measure, this is where people start resigning from their friendship with me.
It's too bad. It's too bad.
Yeah, well,
good for you for saying it.
Well, such people constitute a small loss. My remaining friends are all better than that.
Yes, good. Well, and then it says that Holocaust revisionism does not deny that Jews died for a great number of reasons. Well, okay, you know, that's not saying much. A great number of reasons. So then we'll go on to the next one. It does not deny, revisionism does not deny that other minorities were also persecuted, such as gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, homosexuals, and political dissenters. Now, I don't want to sound cruel and uncaring and totally racist or something, but I will point out that gypsies, while everybody wants to make them into these harmless, charming people, they are shiftless thieves, and they teach their children to steal. And there was a kind of saying in Germany, which I always liked, that when I heard it, that the German women would say, if the gypsies have come to town, take all your laundry in. And, you know, once I was living in Chicago, and I did my laundry down in the basement of this apartment building I lived in, and I hung it up because there was no dryer. And I hung it up there on the line, and one time I came down, and all my panties, I had my panties, they're all gone. So people do come and steal laundry.
Gosh, I'm sure they do, particularly when the laundry happens not to be on your own property. I mean, it's something that apartment dwellers especially face, which I take it you were at the time.
Yes. Yes.
The thing about gypsies in particular, now Jehovah's Witnesses, I think, were imprisoned primarily for their refusal to serve in armies, navies, in the armed forces. And I can well imagine that many of them also declined to work in war industries. Anyway.
Yes, I think that's true. And they did not mind. They had the choice, you know, be loyal to the nation and serve in the army or go to a camp. And they said, we'll go to the camp, you know.
That's what they did.
And they were pretty good camp people. And the Germans actually liked them and gave them a lot of good jobs. And they had a pretty good time. I mean, a pretty fair time. And they got along well with the guards and so on. So, you know, these were upstanding people. They just had their particular beliefs.
Which they were, in all respects, other than this matter of their scruples, they were all, I think, well assimilated, even racially. They were racially Germans. I would look for them to both deserve and receive, I'll just put it, better treatment than Jews, gypsies, and people with a bone to pick, like political dissenters. As for the gypsies constitute a population that tends to be threatening to organized societies. The gypsies resist and defy organization. They will not be registered. They will not be counted. They will not be employed in established businesses. They will not hold jobs nor maintain constant residences. So particularly for more controlling regimes such as the Nazis had, the gypsies constituted quite a threat, and concentration camps, to the contrary, constituted a means of extracting from them benefits that were not otherwise detectable. So
you could put them to work and they would
lock them up afterwards. Yeah. I'm not expressing approval of the measure, but I'm expressing understanding of it. I don't know if you ever heard this said of people who criticized German behavior during World War II, but I read some wag on our side note that it seems to be constantly necessary to remind the opposition that during World War II, there was a war going on.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. And I find that continually coming to my mind. I find that a useful thought.
It
was a war like no American who stayed in America could have the slightest understanding of.
True.
Go ahead.
Well, you're very fair-minded. I'm enjoying this. The homosexuals, a lot is made about how they mistreated, how they put homosexuals in camps. Well, as far as I know, only homosexuals who committed crimes and carrying on homosexual acts in public or being caught, you know, in a public place of some kind was a crime in Germany at the time. And or if they were active political dissenters, which some were. I don't think just being a homosexual, they didn't, cause any problem.
No, as a matter of fact, you're pointing out that among the homosexuals, a distinction as to individual offenses was made. And that's consistent with my information. And I know it would not appeal to you, but it would rather mollify my own feelings if the Jews had been dealt with more in that way. The Jews were persecuted in very thoroughly as a group under the Nuremberg laws that even subjected Mischlinge, half-Jews and quarter-Jews, to second-class citizenship. Now, Mischlinge were not, in all cases, shipped off to concentration camps as full Jews were. But in any case, if the persecution, again, I'm using this word in quotes, if that program had been adopted against Jews in Germany with some greater discernment as to individual guilt or innocence, whether judicially or otherwise, I would condemn the program much less than I do.
Well, you know, here's what I would say, that the Germans saw the Jews as a problem for them, and they thought they had to. It wasn't a matter of individual Jews; it was just a matter of Jews per se, and this was their decision. And if they had gone about it in the way you say, I don't think. And actually, they did to some degree because
yes,
there were still a lot of Jews left in Germany at the end of the war.
Yeah.
But still, and they weren't worrying too much about them. I mean, you know, they could get the number down. But I think if you say. These people are not good for us. They have never been good for us, and our position is that we don't want any of them around. And that was the National Socialist position. They were determined to carry that out. So I don't think that they didn't see Jews. This is what I meant to say. They didn't see Jews the way you see Jews.
I don't argue that approach to the Jews could necessarily have been either practical or justified. Jews or any racial religious group differ from a group like homosexuals in organic ways. To begin with, they're in families. Homosexuals are necessarily not the children of homosexuals. Moreover, they do not themselves have children. So there's no family aspect to them, really. And secondly, homosexuality at that time in particular was not an idealism. It was not a creed. It was more in the nature of a tendency, and I would imagine that at least some homosexuals claimed that they couldn't help being the way they were. It still happens today, although rarely. Whereas Jewishness and Judaism, well, they're a religion and a creed and an ethnos and families and so on. So, the situation is so different that I can only say that well, wouldn't it have been less horrible if the Jews could somehow have been treated in that way? I cannot claim that it would have been practical or effective. But
okay, well,
anyway, it just occurred to me. Oh, sorry. How did I do that?
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah. I'm done.
Well, that's very good, because I just found another email, and it addresses this in a way. So I'm going to read what this emailer, this listener has written. He says, Jews had only enjoyed civil rights in Germany since 1848. In the course of German history, that is not a long, that's not a long time. Properly speaking, the Holocaust means an alleged attempt by the government of Germany to kill all the Jews with gas. The Holocaust is essentially a rumor about why Jews were being rounded up and sent to camps. That's what we're going to talk about a little bit further on here. So let me, let's finish up this before I go to that. All right, so we're now the last one. We're almost done here. And in fact, we are done, because the last item is, and finally, it does, revisionism does not deny that all the above mentioned things were unjust. And I say, well, I deny that these things were unjust. I could be wrong. I could be argued out of it. But my position is that I don't just accept that these things were unjust as for the reasons I've put forth. And I imagine I could come up with some others or better ones, or maybe I could borrow some from other people. But and then they do say, this page does say after this, none of these crimes, which I don't like that word, crimes, of the National Socialist regime are doubted by Holocaust revisionists. And so I would rather not call them crimes, because, as I say, I see them as actions taken in self-defense.
I wouldn't use that word. They became legal crimes through pronouncements enacted by and in foreign countries after practically all these acts had been committed. It is perhaps overly, what word do I want to call it, accommodating to our esteemed opponents to call them crimes. I would not grant that term, despite the extensive pseudo-legal basis that exists for calling them that.
Well, very good. You're really good, Jet. And now let me tell you that, since you are associated with CODO, that at this time, at the CODO website, and of course it's been redesigned, so now at the top they have a thing that says about us or something like that, which I read, and it wasn't, I guess it had existed before, but it wasn't dominant on the website, so I had never seen it. Because I looked, when they had the old website up again for a while, and I checked that out, and I said, well, I don't see this here anywhere. But anyway, the word crimes of the National Socialist regime was used several times. Of course, it wasn't only talking about these things, it was talking about the gassing and so on too, I guess. But, I thought that that they emphasized that too much, and I told that to Bradley Smith, and he went and he said, oh, I'll take a look at this. Then he said, oh, this is something I wrote a long time ago, but he still agreed with it. He thought it was all right. So I think you should take a look at that and see if you don't think that maybe you should, could, if you think that fits there, and maybe suggest something else.
I'll huddle with Bradley about it. I'm looking at the CODO website now, and I see labels taken from cans of Cyclone B, and I'm thinking about the crimes committed with Cyclone B, and it occurs to me that Cyclone B was used to murder millions upon millions of innocent lice. It was a crime against lice in one way of looking at it, and perhaps a is it Buddhists that?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking from the point of view of the lice,
of
as
lot.
Most of this Holocaust is from the point of view of the Jews. Yeah. But if we're looking from the point of view of the lice, then they have a complaint, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I'd be incensed if I were a louse.
Yeah, everybody has a right to live. So, you know, that even that can be questioned. But we're not supposed to in our democratic society or our phony society. We're not supposed to say anything like that, or that's horrible. Okay, well then, I say if what I have said here about these items is accepted, and I'm not saying it is, and you don't accept it all, but if it were, there was no Holocaust. There's no Holocaust because of what Holocaust means, right? And so we'll go into that now, in the little time that we have left, that, you know, of course, Holocaust, it says here on this page, and in number four, item number four on this webpage, that it is the near total, it's understood by, I guess, the Holocaust people, that it's the near total extermination of a distinct group of persons through violence. And here, the near total extermination, actually, I could say a lot of things here, but I would rather skip down to this article by Carl Nordling, in which I found, he wrote this for the How Many Jews Died in the German Concentration Camps. Let's just go to that in the small time we have left. This was published in the Journal of Historical Review in 1991, and I note this is before Weber took over, so he can't be taking credit for articles like this. But Carl Nordling was a Finnish-born architect. He's an urban planner and a historian. And they say a lot of good things about him here. He's a statistician. He applies statistical methods to a number of scientific problems and published a large number of articles, mainly in his native Swedish. Swedish. Internationally, he is best known for whatever. He's been in English-language peer-reviewed scientific journals. So he's quite a scholar. And he is recommending here Walter Sanning's book on the dissolution of East European Jewry, which I imagine you're familiar with, which is Sanning went in trying to figure out the demographics, what happened to the Jews, and if we could tell how many Jews were actually missing after the war, after 1945, and how many were there before, and therefore how many died, and so on. And he starts out by saying that the majority of those who were interned in the German concentration camps, this is Nordling's article. The majority of those who were interned in the German concentration camps did not return to their homes after liberation, and that the common belief that about 6 million Jews died in the camps, that's the common belief, and most laymen presume that this was proven by the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg in 1946, but this court did not prove anything of the sort, and this whole idea has been modified, even though it's still used in the popular press, the 6 million number, but serious historians hardly ever use it, or don't use it. Now then, he talks about Walter Sanning's book, The Dissolution of Eastern European Jewry. And, before I just go through a whole lot of this and maybe bore people to death, I will say that he says he spent 3 decades working professionally with this same kind of demographic complexes and processes that Sanning used, and he finds Sanning to be his work to be very good, high quality. He thinks he's done as well as could be done. And he goes to the Jewish encyclopedias and all kinds of Jewish books to find the population numbers and so on. And there's a whole process, and I've gone through it all here, but instead of reading it all, I will just go to the end and say that our general conclusion, he says, must be that the question posed cannot be answered with any precision, but the general magnitude was certainly 500,000 Jews who survived. The deaths, okay.
Yeah.
But the actual number, okay, the general magnitude was certainly 500,000, but the actual number of Jews who died in the German concentration camps might well have been as low as 300,000 or as high as 600,000. And that's there's a lot more that can be said about this and how they came to this, and he describes it all. But this is the bottom line here. 300. Now this is the concentration camps, and that's why they're now trying to make a big deal out of Jews being murdered by gunshot all over Eastern Europe and in Russia.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because of this, but still the general myth is that, you know, in these camps, all these people were being murdered, and by the hundreds of thousands, and end up a couple of million. But he says it couldn't have been more than, and this is deaths. So a lot of they show how a lot of deaths are natural causes and would naturally occur and so on.
Would have occurred, yes. Mm-hmm.
So this has been available for a long time, but you can't. Because it's not something you can prove precisely with, you know, forensic evidence or something, people always attack it. I mean, the Holocaust historians will attack it and so on. So, but again, we're coming to the whole idea that, the idea that there was no Holocaust, and we shouldn't be using that word for it. I mean, we shouldn't be going along with it. Another problem that I have, I can bring it back to this, with conservative revisionism is that they accept that there was a Holocaust. And how many say, right in the beginning, so that they won't be, you know, rejected right away, I don't deny, they won't say I don't deny the Holocaust. They say, do they use the word Holocaust? They will say, I don't deny that the Jews, like I said in these earlier things, Jews were persecuted, Jews suffered, blah, blah. Mark Weber will say, along with David Irving, millions of Jews died because they were pulled from their homes and put into camps and so on. So, you know, this is ridiculous.
Well, to me, the use of the term, the appropriation of the term Holocaust, is one of the most successful branding enterprises in the history of propaganda. Holocaust, although I find the term doesn't fit well, I was again conditioned to the nuclear one, but it became a container. I could say a trash can, but maybe to others a treasure chest. And this container, once established, was receptive of and could accommodate a vast and growing body, first of exaggerations and then of outright fabrications, like the use of Cyclone B and the existence of gas chambers. Holocaust has become such a successful term that those of us who, I'll use one of their favorite verbs, those of us who deny it, we use the term too. It reminds me a bit of the term capitalist, which capitalists use to describe and refer to themselves. This term capitalism was invented by Karl Marx in his diatribes against it. it is such a successful branding undertaking that we are almost compelled to use the word ourselves. And by the way, the word Holocaust, one of the things besides denier that it's coupled with is survivor. And I have managed to part company with that word. I consider that, okay, that thing that people have in mind as the Holocaust was something to survive, somewhat like a war. And those who survive wars are called veterans, at least those who survive them as troops. So I refer now to people who were put into concentration and labor and other kinds of camps as veterans. I do not use the word survivor. They were not taken to be killed in the first place. they were taken involuntarily, just like, in my opinion, the majority of soldiers who are drafted by their countries and sometimes by other countries. at least I have gotten away from this word survivor or victim. I use the term veteran, and I hope others will too.
Good for you. I'm trying to change using words, and I don't want to use the word Holocaust. And then the other word they have is Shoah, which isn't quite the same. You know, it doesn't have to mean fire. It just means.
It means disaster. It's just the same thing as Nakba. Nakba is Arabic for Shoah. Shoah is Hebrew, I think.
Yeah, and then I'm going to use, I think it was really, what really happened to the Jews was deportation. I mean, really, all their suffering, that's what it stems from, and that's what was done to them. Which, if you could say something was done that was wrong to them, was this idea that they were forcibly taken and deported, and then there was no place to put them, so they put them into camps, and then they put them to work and so on. Mm-hmm. But, so
Shoah is at least descriptive from the standpoint of the victim. I find it's a good deal more apt than Holocaust. Holocaust is purely, it's simply theatrical when you think about what it means.
Well, do you think then, okay, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm kind of in a hurry here. Do you think that it means that that's enough that there should be a kind of a campaign among Holocaust revisionists to quit using the word? How would that, could that happen? How would it happen? Because all these books, everything that's written and all, we're always using that word.
I like the idea of the campaign. I resist propagandistic terms when discussing what is called Obamacare nowadays. I do not discuss it in terms of health care. I discuss it in terms of medical services. I think resisting the term, our vocabularies abound with these terms. They're all foisted on us by propagandists and pundits. And we may have to use the term Holocaust as a reference to the common term for what we're talking about, say, in an introduction to a piece of material. But otherwise, the only proper use of the term would be in the course of objecting to being called, or for that matter, accepting being called, a Holocaust denier.
Well, of course, a lot of people, it just occurred to me that a lot of people are, that's why they use the term holo-hoax or other variations like that. So as not to say it, and what do you feel about that? That offends some people, who consider themselves revisionists, who think it seems cheap and
it's confrontative. I'd give it that. It uses a word that, as far as I'm concerned, Arthur Butz has well qualified for use with that prefix holo. Although Butz himself did not use the neologism, he did use hoax, and I think when he wrote his book, the word Holocaust had acquired its present meaning only rather recently, and I don't know how much he used it. He did not use it in his title, for example.
No, and you know, how courageous and how really radical of him to use the word hoax in 1978.
I can almost say he surely did not, as I did not in 2009. I did not anticipate the reactions that I would get from expressing an honest opinion arrived at with rather more than due consideration. Butz must have been in that situation, only much worse. And what I have to say for Butz, let's say that Butz was caught by surprise. Well, you know something? I have never detected in anything he said or wrote the slightest inclination to back down, give in, apologize. He does not counterattack. He maintains his intellectual rigor. To me, is a monument. I worship the man.
That's very good on the word Holocaust. What about anti-Semitism? And I go so far as to say that anti-Semitism has been justified wherever it has appeared. There's been reason for it, and we should also not back down from that.
Well, to call me an anti-Semite is to, in my case, to misdescribe my views and sentiments. I certainly have been called that, and I expect to continue to be. I'm beyond being indignant about it. I'm resigned to being called that.
Well, let me just say that I would not call you an anti-Semite. I understand that you're not.
No, yeah,
but,
exactly.
But I am defending anti-Semitism as being justified.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not irrational hate. It has never been irrational hate.
No, I agree with you there, and I would not mix you up with any person, real or imagined, who advocated the extermination of the objects of your distaste. There are people, I suppose, who advocate that, maybe particularly in Arab or Muslim countries. But anyway, you're not one.
Well, you know, a lot of people who end up advocating, and you can't really take them too seriously because they're not putting themselves on the line with it, but they say it. They advocate, well, the only answer to the Jewish problem is to just get rid of all the Jews. I've said myself, you need to put them on a different planet because they're always going to cause trouble. I lost my train of thought here. I don't even know what I was going
to
say.
May have had something to do with mass deportation or confinement.
Well, they say that. Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, mm-hmm. They say that because they don't have any other answers, because the history of dealing mm-hmm. with Jews on mass is very difficult. You never get anywhere with it.
Nothing that novel about this thing we reluctantly call the Holocaust. It has dozens of precedents in history, and that is specifically with regard to Jews. It also has some precedent with regard to some other peoples.
Yes, but what about the Jewish problem now, as I've joked that? Mm-hmm. People that really see it as very serious and as creating actual genocide for whites. And whites in their homelands, let's say. I mean, you know, who is behind the problems that we are having in our European and American and Australian, Canadian homelands? We are becoming a minority. And this now may wake people up somewhat who weren't awake to it before. This creates a problem that says we need to push back really, really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as the pushing back to that pushing back mounts, time goes by, the problems get worse, desperation rises, let's say on both sides, and then something terrible happens again, or something that, World War II was terrible, and I consider it, in terms of its scope, to have been largely brought about by Jews and interests sympathetic to Jews. I believe it would not have been a world war had there not been the resistance to the National Socialists' Jewish policies. And that is a statement of counterfact. That is a statement of something you cannot know, because you can't go back and rerun the experiment with, shall we say, with the Jewish issue removed from it. So it will remain forever a speculation. But it is mine after long study, Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it's yours.
Well, that's a pretty strong statement you made. I like that. But
yeah,
now,
you would.
do you think that what would be the best move for Holocaust revisionism now to become more effective? We keep putting out very good information and countering what's been said, but do you think it needs to become more radical or more aggressive?
I don't necessarily think so. I am struck with the great vigor. Oh, boy, we're getting close. Okay.
Yeah.
Vigor and growth of the movement. And to tell you the truth, I rather think that keeping on, keeping on may be our ticket. It is mine for the time being.
Okay, well, that's a very clear statement, and I appreciate that. And I've enjoyed this very much with you, Jet, and you're a very smart fellow. You have a great grasp of all the background knowledge of all this. So I want to thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you, Carolyn, for inviting me.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad to get to know you because we've had a few incidents in the past, not much. Always for me, because I'm kind of I get kind of angry without knowing too much of the background of things. But you have commented on my Elie Wiesel blog.
Oh yes, it's
quite
excellent.
A few times, and that was nice of you to do that.
Thank you.
So I appreciate that.
Okay.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that does it for this program. I hope you enjoyed it. And this has been Jet Rucker and Carolyn Yeager, and asking you to come back next week.
Okay, Carolyn, I clicked on your picture, but I hear the music. Am I on mic?
Might be. Not.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyeager.com.